Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and welcome back, Cory Doctorow. I was trying to remember how many times we've done this. This might be our fourth time, and the last one wasn't that long ago to talk about eugenification, like 6-8 months ago. I feel like it can't have been that long.
Yeah, I write when I'm anxious. So I wrote 9 books during lockdown, several books since. The hits keep on coming. So long as the world is terrible, I will keep writing.
When you say the hits keep on coming, do you mean the books keep coming out and are popular, or do you mean the blows are raining down on you in continuous pain?
I mean, ¿por qué no los dos?
I sort of figured it was that way. All right, well, we are here today to talk about, I've got the book in front of me so I can get the title right, The Reverse Centaur's Guide to Life After AI. The first thing I need to say is when I started telling people about this book, I realized I don't have a definitive way to pronounce this word centaur, which I've been seeing since I was a child. You know, I think my first centaur was in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Sure.
But I keep saying centaur. I can't do it right.
Centaur. I'm not sure. I'm not Greek. And even if I were Greek, I wouldn't be ancient Greek. So I can't tell you.
Yeah, I guess it should be like dinosaur. But I think I say centaur, like, you know, like an old salt tar. But
I mean, my biggest touch point for it is the Monster Manual. So I'm hardly an authority here.
So a centaur, since I took us down this road, a centaur is a mythical Greek creature, very majestic, very much enmeshed in the modern fantasy lexicon. Now, I mentioned that they show up in The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, or at least they're in Narnia. I'm not sure if they're in the first book. They're definitely in Harry Potter. I don't think they're called centaurs, but you can fight centaurs in, I think, all the Legend of Zelda games, but they have a special name. And they're really majestic and wonderful, and they have all the best parts of the human, which is to say the torso, so they can write and speak and be beautiful. But their bottom half is a horse, so they are hugely powerful and amazing and can run and, you know, presumably don't need bathrooms. I don't know. There's probably some downsides to being a centaur, but centaurs are awesome. Mm-hmm. And I'll just let you take it away from here, because reverse centaurs are not awesome. So can you tell us what a reverse centaur is?
Well, it's a truism among people who study the history of automation that when automation is driven by workers, it tends to preference quality. And when automation is driven by bosses, it tends to preference throughput. And that's not like necessarily because bosses are evil mustache twirling villains. It's that they own an asset that they are trying to amortize or rather maximize the value of before it amortizes off their balance sheets, right, as it depreciates. And typically the machine can work faster and longer than a person. That's kind of in our conception of machines. And so as a person who's acquired a tool, you just don't have the same imperatives. But as a boss who's got a tool they need someone else to use, you're going to work that person as hard as you can so that you can work that asset as hard as you can. Because it's an asset. It's not a tool. And so in automation theory, we call people who are using a tool because they choose to improve their work, we call them centaurs. They're the human head driving a machine body, and the machine is tireless in a way that the human is not. And so it's a sort of endless helpmeet, and that's a car or a bicycle or a spell checker that can remain attentive to your typos long after you're too tired to focus on the type, and so on and so on. And a reverse centaur then is obviously a person who's been conscripted to help a machine. It's a machine riding a human's frail body and directing the human. And so you can think here of the classic sight gags and, you know, Charlie Chaplin in Modern Times.
Yes.
Or Lucy and Ethel working on the assembly line, putting chocolates in the chocolate boxes. And the reason the boss is running the assembly line so fast that, you know, spoiler alert, they eventually are not able to get the chocolates into the boxes and they're flying all over the place to great comedic effect, is that they are the bottleneck, right? And so you run the system at the speed of the bottleneck. But the thing is that as a human who is the bottleneck, you slow down over time. You are not inexhaustible. And so reverse centaurs aren't just used by machines. They're typically used up by machines. You know, the most automated warehouses in America are Amazon's warehouses. And that's also the warehouses where workers experience the most injuries. They're injured at three times the rate of workers in comparable warehouses.
So I think, you know, I think this metaphor is fantastic. I've really been enjoying it. I really like the book. I have lots of questions and thoughts about the book that we can get to. But I want to say now that, well, here, when I was talking to Brian Merchant and I was talking about how, you know, people are losing jobs to AI. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, this isn't a problem about AI or jobs or this isn't a problem about AI or automation. It's a problem with jobs. Like when you lose your job, it's the best thing that ever happens to you, except for the fact that your job is how you get your food, your shelter, your healthcare, and your sense of meaning in life. But in a theoretical world, having a job is the worst thing that can happen to you. You should not want to have a job in the sense of having a boss who has all these demands on you and when you are and where you have to be and everything. And so it seems to me that one way of putting all of this, everything that we're arguing now about with AI, I don't mean that you and I are arguing about, but as the civilizational argument that we're having just sort of comes down to, we've kind of got this deal where bosses get whatever they want, and then the workers don't get much, and the bosses want to rewrite the deal so that the workers get less. And we're having this conversation of like, how are we going to pay artists in the age of AI? But we could really just have a pretty simple conversation, which is like, how did bosses end up with so much power? And can we just have some power back from the bosses?
So that's a conversation I'd love to have, but I do want to quibble with this characterization a little, because it contains a hidden assumption, and it is that assumption that I'm railing against within the book, which is that AI can do what they say it can do. So you are taking as read the idea that the AI can do your job. And let me gently suggest that while an AI salesman can absolutely convince your boss to fire you and replace you with an AI that can't do your job, that this is in many ways divorced from the question of whether the AI can do your job. And back to preferencing throughput over quality, you know, we have an arrangement that is downstream of this arrangement that I think you're rightly declaiming, which is that your boss is in charge of you and you have to do what they say or you starve to death, whereby your boss can fire most of your colleagues, make you feel very immiserated and panicked and endangered, and then put you in charge of marking the AI's homework, and then blame you when the AI makes a mistake that you didn't catch because you were being asked to mark homework at a rate that exceeds the ability of any human to do so over long periods of time. And you're being asked to do it with every hour that God sends. And so you become what Dan Davies calls the AI's accountability sink. And so if you care about the work that you do, even if you might not like doing it for your boss, and if you care about the people who benefit from your work, and if you also, you know, care about your own living standards, you might care about capitalism as a foundational matter, but you also might say, even under capitalism, this is a worse capitalism because it's one in which the thing that I do that matters to me is done badly by machines. And I and the people who consume that service, well, we all suffer as a result.
Yeah, I think this is absolutely right. And you could not be more right that the idea of, you know, can the AI do your job is, This is a silly and wrong thing. As we are sitting here in the year 2026, there are, I mean, it seems like AI is eating up some coding jobs, but as a general rule, I agree with you completely. If someone is being fired because AI can do their job, that is because, as you say, a boss has become convinced they can. Maybe not even that the AI can do your job, but that it won't hurt the bottom line to fire you, which is different from you're fired and the next day they put a little box where your office was and the box does exactly what you did, but better and for less. That is almost not happening right now.
And so to connect this to enshittification, part of the thesis of enshittification is that companies treat you badly for the same reason your dog licks its balls, because they can, right? And, you know, no one stops them. And so when you have a monopoly, or where you're part of a cartel, when standards decline in lockstep, when prices rise in lockstep, when new market entry has been walled off by a mix of capital moats, state capture, and other, you know, underhanded mechanisms like exclusive arrangements with key suppliers or key retailers, then you have an enormous amount of latitude to make a worse product at a worse price and not see a concomitant drop in income, which means that the surplus generated by not spending as much money making the product good or selling it at a fair price, that surplus is yours and your investors to capture. And so I don't think we would have, you know, if so, say every route that people traveled on was served by 10 airlines instead of, practically speaking, one or maybe two. Yeah. The airline that outsourced all of its customer service to the chatbot that couldn't solve any of your problems and fired all the people who would be at the gate when your plane was delayed and you missed your connection and said instead, get online and talk to the chatbot, that airline would lose your business, right? So when we allow for the monopolistic capture of a whole sector by a cartel, they can all worsen service in lockstep and keep the residual that arises from basically shifting costs to you. Well, it's a mix. So they shift value to themselves at your expense, and they shift consequences to the few remaining flesh and blood workers that you go and shout at their expense.
Yeah. Yeah. This is completely right. And for one thing, it calls into question, this is something that I've been trying to make since then for a while, it calls into question the very idea of what capitalism is. I mean, I sort of see there's two ways of reading what capitalism is. One of them, I mean, you have the slogan, capitalists hate capitalism, and I like that, which is to say, the world that Adam Smith described, which mm-hmm. is where...
Noted socialist agitator Adam Smith.
Yeah, I mean, he's anti-capitalist in the sense that people describe capitalism now. Adam Smith basically says, the goal of society is to get the people who have money to do useful things with it, to compete with one another. This competition will make the world better. And if we ever notice, I mean, I've never read all the way through that book. I don't know if anyone has, but I was just reading a bit of it. And he says, you know, really high profits are a sign that something has gone wrong.
Sure.
And if the system is generating lots of profits, you're doing it wrong and competition isn't functioning. So the people who defend capitalism like to quote Adam Smith. And I just like to say, like, that's great. That's great. If that's what capitalism is, yeah, fantastic. Let's do this. He also says corporations are bad and you shouldn't have corporations. That's another thing Adam Smith says. So the other thing that capitalism is what Marx describes, which is the people who have money using it to command other people to get more money at the expense of those other people. Mm-hmm. These are both called capitalism, but they're not just different. They're actually diametrically opposed to one another.
I don't think so. No. I think they're completely commensurable. It's just a question of whether you think the... So I think Smith might say that, and I should point out, Karl Marx coined the term capitalism. Adam Smith is writing Marx fanfic. But what Smith would say is that the only way to organize a society to increase productivity to meet the material needs of the widest group of people is to use competition. That's the effective way. And Smith and Marx, they're both reacting to Rentierism, to feudalism, right? Where it does run basically on whim. Yeah. And where just people starve to death because it just turns out that, like, you know, which orifice you emerge from does not predict whether or not you're good at allocating resources, right? So, you know, they're both reacting to this. And Marx, you know, you read chapter one of the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels are just like, can you believe how amazing capitalism is? Look at all the production it has done and the material improvements it's made. Think of what we can do when we eliminate this negative trait that is intrinsic to capitalism, which is that it creates this hierarchical system by which capital allocators command the labor and activity and alienate the products of the labor of working people. But they're not, I don't think that these are incommensurable. The disagreement is not whether capitalism does that. The disagreement is whether capitalism is the only way to do it.
I would say Smith says, if you let enough capital accumulate in a few hands, competition will cease.
Yeah, and sure.
And what's good about the system is competition. So the world in which capital has accumulated is no longer what Smith is describing. Sure.
Well, and even more so, David Ricardo is really the father of the idea of a free market. We often attribute that to Smith, but it's Ricardo. When Ricardo talked about a free market, he didn't mean a market free from regulation. He meant a market free from rents, right? He meant a market where the factors of production were not owned by an unproductive finance sector who could extract a tax on everyone who did things because they owned the building or the machine or the patent or the trade route or the exclusive contracts with a retailer, or that they were the only retailer that could reach a certain audience or what have you. That was their major concern. Someone who is by no means convinced that markets are the best or only way to allocate our resources, I don't like competition merely because it sometimes improves production. I like competition because it makes firms into a squabbling rabble instead of a unified cartel. 200 companies can't agree on what their legislative agenda is, but five can. And so if we're to have a hope of having a system in which we regulate firms, we need to shatter their solidarity, because that's where this class solidarity of the business lobby is. And I do think that it's a valid question to ask of people who favor a democratically controlled institution that steps in where we rely on the admittedly inefficient matter of squabbling firms to achieve it, how you keep that power accountable. Right. And I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying, how do you do it? And there's an interesting book out these days from, I've just blanked his name, but the guy who wrote The Lean Startup has a new book called Incorruptible. And he talks about the collapse of corporate governance models. And he says, imagine you were a political scientist and someone showed up and said, we're founding a new country. We have two models for governance and we need you to tell us which one is good. So one is absolute lifetime dictatorship, where no one gets to tell me what to do. The other one is that everyone gets a vote, including people who moved here 10 seconds ago and who leave as soon as the vote is over. Which one of those will produce the optimal system of governance? So I, again, without wanting to say markets are the best or only way to allocate things, I do think that we live in a world that Adam Smith and David Ricardo and Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels would call impoverished in terms of its conception of capitalism.
Yes, I completely agree. And that actually, this is so perfect, because let's go to Hayek and then I'll get to back to your book. Because Hayek says, you know, the reason why markets work so well is that every single person in the entire world gets a real say. They get to vote with their dollar in terms of what is being produced. And as you have outlined really well, in fact, what is being produced is decided by what a relatively small number of Wall Street financiers think will possibly be profitable in future decades. It could not be.
No, in short term, not in future decades, in the short term. At the expense, often, I want you to finish this point, but just let me intervene here just quickly. Frontier, the worst ISP in America, went bankrupt during the first year of the pandemic, during the lockdowns. And one of the things we found out when we got to see their books, because of the bankruptcy, was that they had correctly assessed that they could make $10 billion in fiber by doing fiber rollouts over 10 years, right? In pure profit, but that it wouldn't start earning until like year 8. And they knew that the analysts, the small number of analysts who dominate buy decisions for institutional investors in telecoms companies, automatically downranked any firm that made capital expenditure investments that had an amortization schedule that was more than 5 years long. And moreover, the executives in this firm were primarily compensated in stock, which is supposed to align their interests with the interests of shareholders, which meant that they would immediately lose half of their net worth if they made the investment that would make $10 billion in profit for the company. And so neither the investors nor the executives got to reap the benefit, and especially not the people who relied on them. And remember, this was in the run-up to the pandemic that they took this decision. And this was the period in which if your internet stopped working, which Frontier's did all the time, that you just lost access to the entire outside world. So all of these people, this is the opposite of Marx, right? All of these people and Smith lost the benefit. The investors, the executives, the customers, they all lost the benefit of broadband. And not for nothing, Frontier explicitly valued places where they had fewer competitors. So on their books, they had booked as an asset the 1 million customers they had that had no broadband alternatives, where they were the only ISP. These were customers whose franchises they bought from AT&T when AT&T did anti-competitive mergers and had to sell off part of it. So they knew, right? Where we don't have competitors, we can treat people worse. So there is the intersection there of where Ricardo, Marx, Smith, and Engels all agree that this was the likely outcome.
Okay, well, I mean, that's fantastic. I guess, I mean, I need to slightly revise the long term. So what it is they think that there will be huge profits in the long term, and they can get tons of money right now, basically from the debt market on these long-term profits. The obvious thing is, you know, Elon Musk is not making this much money right now on Skynet or whatever, Starlink, whatever he calls that thing, SpaceX, but he can get tons of money from people right now, which is basically it's debt money on the assumption that it's going to make trillions of dollars 10 years from now. And so what we have, rather than everyone in the world, you know, if you buy more potatoes, people make more potatoes, and therefore capitalism works because if you like potatoes, potatoes will get cheaper, which is what which is what Hayek says. Instead, basically, you have people who are science fiction storytellers explaining how their AI or satellites or whatever is going to make lots of money in the future. And if your science fiction story is compelling to a relatively small number of people, the market will give you as much money as you want, even if that means people starve due to lack of potatoes.
So can I revise that just a little here?
Yeah, of course, of course.
I never remember if it was Keynes or Galbraith who talked about the beauty contest, where the idea of a market is not to predict who will win the beauty contest, it's to predict who other people think will win the beauty contest, right? And that's the speculative nature of markets. John Quiggin at Crooked Timber, as we record today, wrote this morning about how the cryptocurrency bubble, which you notice people don't even call cryptocurrency anymore. They just call it crypto because no one's pretending it's a currency anymore. It is a pure speculative asset. And how the cryptocurrency bubble really showed that contemporary markets are ones that are driven by what Smith would have called animal sentiments and what we might call vibes. And that people buy these without any hope of a return. They buy them effectively as collectibles, these commodities. And so it is possible, and I think likely, that the debt markets that you're describing are not, in fact, making a bet on the long-term health of Elon Musk's money furnace, aka XAI. They are making a bet on whether or not normies will be suckers, right? And and even more so, I think the original bet was, can Elon Musk game the stock indexes, which he almost did and was not able to do because he suckered the S&P and NASDAQ into including XAI in the indexes of top stocks without making it go through the mandatory waiting period, what's called the seasoning period, where, you know, after a stock enters the top 100 or top 500 of the exchange, it takes several quarters of consecutive growth and profitability before it's eligible for inclusion in the index, because the indexes are where everyone put their money, right? For 50 years now, employers have been drawing down the defined benefits pension, where you just work, and then when you retire, you're guaranteed not to starve, with a market pension where you work, gamble money, and if you win your bet, you don't starve. And so the advice we've all been given is don't try and gamble in the stock market because you're the sucker at the table. Give your money to people who will spread it out across all the stocks that are being traded by everyone. What's called an index fund, where you're effectively betting on the movement of the whole market. And then on average, you will win what the winners win. And that's such ubiquitous advice that it's indeed what Warren Buffett told his wife to do when he dies. Take all of our savings and just put them in an index fund. And by including XAI, SpaceX in the index fund at IPO, it would force every index fund, Vanguard, Fidelity, and so on, to immediately buy all the outstanding shares and all the insider shares, because he also got a waiver on the prohibition on insiders selling the stocks right away, so that all of the bankers who gave him the money could immediately flood the market with stock, because they're actually restricting the outstanding shares they were going to sell. They weren't going to sell a lot of shares from the company. It was all going to be insider shares. And all of our retirement funds would have been forced to buy it at whatever price it was at, because they'd highly restricted the supply. And it would be irrespective of whether or not the fundamentals of the business could possibly defensibly account for its valuation. And we would be the bag holders for the money furnace and for his, unprofitable bet on Twitter.
Yeah. And this is really important stuff. And that's why I wanted to make sure to bring it up, because this happened. I assume the book isn't going to be able to cover the SpaceX IPO.
No, sure. But, no, it's the book is on shelves. So,
yeah. But this is the copy. Same. Yeah. I have a copy of it as well, but it says preview edition.
Copy. Yeah.
But this is the reason why. I mean, partly AI is part of this thing that Musk is doing. Although there, space is also part of it. But this is what every AI company is doing right now, is trying to convince people that the Star Trek future is just around the corner, mm-hmm. except unlike Star Trek, it's going to be run by capitalists instead of a form of communism. And you can get in on the ground floor right now, even though AI doesn't make any money right now.
So, yeah. So one way to think about this book is it's a investigation into why there are tech bubbles and why this tech bubble exists. And I think the answer for why there are tech bubbles is that firms it's all finance, right? The firms that saturate their markets are unlikely to continue growing, right? Just by definition, right? Google has a 90% market share. They're not growing, right? And so the problem with that is that firms that are growing enjoy a very high valuation, because a share is formally claim on the future earnings of a company. And so if the earnings are growing, then those future earnings are worth more than those future earnings mean that the share is worth more than a share in a firm with the same financials, but that isn't growing, because their financials will be the same year in, year out. So, GM versus Tesla is the example we can all think about here. And so that's very bad, because when a firm stops growing, it means that its shares are grossly overvalued. And this is why we see these punctuated panicked sell-offs in the shares of tech companies whenever they report not like contraction, but declining growth.
Yeah.
And I do think one of the things that AI is allowing these companies to do is hide contraction by actually reporting it as AI layoffs. So you said before, oh, the programmers are maybe having their jobs done by AI. I think it's very hard to know whether that's programmers getting their jobs done by AI or Facebook avoiding another mass sell-off of its shares by reporting that all the programmers they fired were not because their business is shitting the bed, but because AI is so cool that their cash basis is improving. So we see this series of bubbles, because when you have this sell-off, not only do the executives in the company lose a lot of their money, but the share becomes less liquid. Right? If your company is a mature company, people don't want its stock the way they want the growth stock. You can't trade it like cash, which means you can't buy companies by giving them stock, which means you can't grow by buying companies by giving them stock. You can't just like type zeros into a spreadsheet, acquire another company, and double your size, right? Which is a thing that you get the privilege of when you have a growth stock. And so it's a very dangerous valley to be in, right? Or inflection point to be in. And so these companies have been assaying different gambits, narrative gambits, to talk about how they're going to continue to grow after they saturated. The early ones were all about capturing each other's markets. Pivot to video would make Facebook YouTube. Google Plus would make Google into Facebook. Those are grounded in at least some kind of defensible numbers, because you say, well, look, how much is Facebook worth? We just have to go look at Facebook's balance sheet. That's how much more Google will be worth once we've absorbed their business. Mm-hmm. The problem is that Facebook is like not shy about explaining why that's not going to happen. And so it is a less credible, potentially less credible claim than claiming that you're going to conquer a market that doesn't exist. And obviously that has the credibility problem that the market doesn't exist, but it doesn't have anyone who will tell you what it's worth. So if you say it's worth a lot of money, it's very hard to say it's not. I mean, the thing I just imagined is worth as much as I say it is, right? And it also means that there's no one who owns that market who will dispute your ability to conquer it, which is how we got crypto and Web3 and metaverse and so on. And now we have AI, and so AI can be seen as in this lineage, but it is not directly in the lineage because it's so much bigger. They, you know, Meta wasted $61 billion on Metaverse. They spent $150 billion in the last 3 years on AI, and they've committed another $150 billion this year, and they say the spending's going up next year. And so I'll take a break here, but I'll say that's the material basis for it. And so I think that to understand why materially it's such a large bubble relative to the other bubbles we've had, you have to ask an ideological question.
Yeah, well, I think also the market that they're promising to capture is literally everything. I mean, that's the promise, right? Is you won't have to make food anymore because the AI will make your food. I mean, this is the story. I'm not saying I take it seriously, yeah, but
I just don't think that's different. Right. So if you remember, I think we just forget how stupid the other bubbles were, right? DAOs, which were this thing that was part of cryptocurrency, were going to replace all firms and automate all forms of finance and corporate structure, right? The metaverse would be the place where we met, had sex, worked, went to school. It was what we would do. It would replace the entire travel industry. You know, like they all, this is the everything machine. That's not a new claim. That's the that's intrinsic to claims about bubbles, or at least tech bubbles of the last century. Of this century, rather.
Yeah, I think it's a little more than that, and this takes us back. This could take us back to the Centaur reverse Centaur thing, because sure.
That's the ideological basis.
Yes. Yeah. Go ahead. Take
so,
it on. Yeah,
so there, and I want to say before I get into the ideology, there is a material basis also for liking this more than cryptocurrency, in that it is more real, yeah. Right? AI is in fact. Speaking with in my capacity as a pretend computer scientist with an honorary doctorate in CS, right? It is interesting as a computer science outcome. Some scientists had an existing technique. They applied some variations to it, and they got a substantial improvement in the output. And that improvement continued to scale as they added more resources to it. So sometimes you get a breakthrough in computer science where like, oh, we used to do it this way. And we got this much output, and then we made a slight variation, we got more, but it's very rare to say, and then we did it some more and we got even more, and then we did some more, we got even more than that. That kind of scalability is very exciting. And I think that's one of the reasons. But ideologically, I think bosses are and always have been suckers for claims about how you can replace workers with automation.
Yeah.
Bosses, I think, psychologically or psychoanalytically are haunted by the knowledge that even though they tell themselves they're in the driver's seat, they know that if they don't show up for work, everything keeps going as per usual. But if the workers don't show up for work, nothing happens. And so maybe they're actually in the back seat with a Fisher-Price steering wheel. And what AI is the possibility of wiring a Fisher-Price steering wheel directly into the car's drivetrain, right? It's a workplace without workers, where the boss has an idea. And then that idea turns into code, which turns into a product or a service. And you don't have these like ego-shattering confrontations with people who know how things work. And this is why like one of the motifs of the current vibe coding, narrative is my boss vibe coded a thing that ran on his computer for one user in half an hour. And he wants to know why it would take 50 engineers to make it work for 10 million people on the public internet. And if you know anything about software, you know the answer, right? But your boss doesn't know anything about your software. Your boss has an MBA. Your boss knows the iron law of the MBA, which is fire fucking workers. And so, and then take, and even if you fire too many of them, you hire some back as contractors and you've put the fear of God in them because they know they can be fired and they'll work for less and they'll work longer hours and they won't complain and they won't form a union, right? And so that is like the great promise of this. It is screenplays without screenwriters. It is movies without actors. It's medical facilities without doctors, nurses, and specialists. It's cars without drivers. It's planes without pilots. It's Starbucks without someone who does stock taking. And the thing is, whenever we get AI to do this, instead of asking the people to do this job, what automation would help you do your job, the AI shits the bed, right? Which isn't to say that AI can't help you. Like, it would be very weird. And I want to urge my fellow leftists out here, don't be a person who is ideologically opposed to statistical inference. That's just dumb, right? Like, the social arrangement of this, the reification of it, the horrible stock bubble, all of those things are things to oppose. But being opposed to the idea of statistically inferring things is like, it's just weird and self-limiting and frankly nuts.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I have a lot to say in response to this. We're running out of time. We're two thirds of the way or more done. So first of all, I do think, you know, you touched on, first of all, the ideology. I couldn't agree with the ideological part more. When they wake up in the morning, bosses, and they think about their workers, it terrifies them. Workers terrify them because they have to give workers money. So their dream is not having to give
and
workers
concessions,
money.
Right? That's why they hate unions. It's not the money, right? There are workplaces where they will give you the raise, but not the union.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And AI eliminates all that. So that's the ideological part. That's absolutely right. In terms of there's lots more to say, but let's get into the opposition to AI. And how can I put this? I am okay. So the first thing to say is, in terms of being opposed to AI, it seems to me that being opposed to AI is like completely, fully, absolutely opposed to AI makes complete sense if you don't understand that these, you know, statistical modeling things can be done on a small scale.
Sure.
On a computer, if you think AI costs $150 billion every year,
yeah,
and is
right.
going to poison all the water, which is what they say it is,
right?
Then you should be opposed to AI.
Also, if we didn't have AI, but you found out that the IPCC had just been given $150 billion to build a supercomputer in order to accurately model the climate, no one would be like, oh my God, that's terrible, right?
Yeah.
It's a mix, because there are certain things you need bigger hardware to do. It's just we're using this to make child porn.
I know,
right? And sloth.
I know. So that's the first thing I want to say in terms of, there's no reason to be. I mean, I just feel like the discussion, I mean, this came up a little bit with last time I talked to Brian Merchant, is like the question of what AI is has gotten so muddled. So there's this philosopher who writes for the New York Times named Kwame Anthony Appiah. I'm not sure how to say his name either, just like Centaur, and he writes the Ethicist column, and mm-hmm. somebody asked him about this question of, like, you know, my boss is vibe coding and then wants me to make it happen. And Appiah was like, well, you shouldn't just be opposed. His answer is mostly good. But first, he was like, you shouldn't just be opposed to AI, because AI can do good things. Like, it can help radiologists and it can find flights for you easier. And I just wanted to be like, no, but that's when someone is writing about their anxiety about AI. Mm-hmm. I mean, Pac-Man has an AI. AI just means when computers do things without direct instructions from humans. What we're talking about is machine learning. And then machine learning has all sorts of really, really, really wonderful uses, the vast majority of which have nothing to do with why they are promising that they need $10 trillion every year.
And it's not, and if the story they told was the story that is realistic and beneficial, they wouldn't have that money. And I think that's a thing that a lot of people intuit, but maybe can't articulate. And it's an important gloss, I think.
Yeah, it's just you so... Know, it, go ahead.
So my other life, I'm a science fiction writer. And I am firmly of the belief that science fiction is not about describing gadgets. It's about imagining who the gadget does things for and who it does it to, that it's the social arrangements and the power that is the foundation of what makes science fiction interesting. And Mary Shelley, who wrote the first science fiction novel, was a Luddite writing an allegory about what happens when, I mean, she was literally I'm not speaking figuratively, like she was literally a self-identified supporter of the Luddite movement, as was her husband, whose maiden speech in the Lords was a speech in support of the Luddites, right? So she was writing about what happens when entrepreneurs without any kind of, co-determination from the polity are allowed to just make and deploy any machine they want. And so I think that's very true, and that asking what the machine does is less important than who it does it for and who it does it to. And you mentioned radiologists. This is a subject on my mind. So I have a very treatable form of cancer. The phone call I got just before I got on this call with you is from the nuclear medicine clinic at Kaiser, because I'm going in for a PET scan tomorrow and I'll find out whether my immunotherapy was successful or whether I'm going to need second line immunotherapy or chemotherapy tomorrow. And I'm very interested in the idea that radiology can be improved by AI. And if I believe that the social arrangements of the AI bubble, the way that it's capitalized and the necessity of how it is sold as a consequence of the capitalization, meant that right now there was an AI salesman in the office of the administrator of the Kaiser Hospital in downtown or in Los Angeles on Sunset, where I go see them, saying, look, here's the deal. Right now you're spending $1 million a year for 10 radiologists. I would like you to spend an extra $500,000 a year on this software. The 10 radiologists each review 100 x-rays a day. The AI is going to ask them to go back and look at two of those on average per day. So their output will fall to 98. So you might have to hire another radiologist too, but what you will get is more accurate radiology. I'd be very happy,
yeah.
Right? No one invests in an AI company because they think there's a sales force that makes that pitch, right? And the pitch is much more likely to be fire most of your radiologists, have the software shit out diagnoses, blame the remaining radiologists for the people who die. Make them into accountability sinks. And I've spoken to radiologists who are like, well, you know, there is a real demand for our service. And right now we do have the whip hand, and mostly we're getting to choose how we deploy it. And I think if they're unionized and if they're in charge of their workplace, that might remain true. But that's certainly not the basis on which any investment is being made, right? The investment is entirely driven by the thought that you can fire radiologists and replace them with software.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's why I really love the Centaur and reverse Centaur framing, because it does take it back to that's the Luddites also. I mean, the question was who was going to be in charge of the automating of the workplace. And I mean, think about those goddamn terrible Miyazaki selfies that everyone made of themselves. I don't know how much that cost the world, but I know that no one would have wanted it at the cost that was actually – it's because the market people were giving it away for free. It was slop. Yeah. They looked terrible. I'm sorry. If you thought you have a little selfie and it looks like Miyazaki drew you, it's not true. Miyazaki has never drawn anything as soulless as every single one of those. But leaving that aside, if everyone had to pay $20 for each one of those they got, people would have bought zero of them.
You make a very good point here, because one of the aspects that the inevitabilists who say that resistance to AI is futile, one of the aspects of their argument is, look at how popular it is. Look at how many people use it. Right now, the AI companies are selling $100 bills for $1 a piece, right? It would be pretty amazing if they didn't have a lot of users at that offer. But what's very interesting is in the last couple of weeks, some of the AI companies who are trying to, you know, get their balance sheet in order for IPOs have said, what if we charge $5 for these $100 bills? And every one of their best customers has said, like, we can't afford to pay $5 for these $100 bills, right? They are not a good deal for us when you charge more than a dollar for them. And I think that it's also worth talking about the soullessness of the art. I just wrote something about this morning. I was publishing it when our call started and got interrupted by the call from Kaiser. It's about what I love about technology. Because I had a call with a reporter this weekend who's doing a podcast about the book. And she said, I'm really surprised, because I would think that you would have the profile of someone who'd really like AI. And I said, look, you know, the things that I've loved about technology all my life is the increase in participation, the ability for it to make, to connect people, the ability for people to have more self-determination, and the idiosyncrasy that falls out of that. You know, if you think nothing about us without us, which is the motto of the disability rights movement that says, you know, you shouldn't make technology to help or measures to help disabled people without consulting them. If you think that sounds like a good idea, you know, what's even better, like everyone can just make the things they need, right? They can adapt, they can modify, they can make from whole cloth. And I've always loved technologies that lower the barriers to people making the automation tools for themselves, not because it then becomes production code that's a product. In fact, it is in many cases, in most cases, unmonetizable, because what comes out of it is not suited for mass consumption. It's not secure. It doesn't scale. It works beautifully for one person. And there are many things in my home that I have adapted with my own two hands that could never be a product, but that work great for me. And I think that that should be true of our digital technology too. And when you look at the art that AI makes, it is the opposite of the stuff that we got in the dawn of Photoshop or Microsoft Paint or HyperCard or with desktop publishing, where it was ugly and weird and interesting and idiosyncratic, and it expressed something that no designer could have made because they'd have had to break their hands to make something that was, that violated as many rules of design as they did. It was amateur in every wonderful sense of the word. And one of the things about generative AI output, with the exception of vibe coding, which I'll finish with, but the art, the prose, it is the opposite. It is homogenous, right? John Scalzi just published something about how a publisher that is a reputable publisher sent him an AI generated email where he wrote back and said, did you guys get hacked? Because the only people who send emails like this are scammers, because this is now indistinguishable from scam content. It's fully washed. Now, vibe coding, all we talk about when we talk about vibe coding is your boss is going to be able to fire you and code up the thing in an afternoon. Bullshit, right? But can you vibe code the thing that like does what Apple Script and shell scripting and cron jobs and all those other like desktop automation tools that no normie can figure out how to use, but which power users totally change their life with? Can you vibe code a thing that just does, wires one thing into another thing? Totally. My housemate is putting up a Plex server and we put all 50,000 of my MP3s on it. And then it turns out that it barfs if the MP3s don't have ID3 tags. So he's vibe coded a thing that just pastes, you know, arbitrary ID3 tags. It's actually pulling from MetaBrains, the ID3 tags, but he vibe coded it. And if it doesn't work perfectly, it's fine. Mm-hmm. Right. And we're never going to sell it. We're never going to give it away. It's just a thing that works to get our 50,000 tracks into our Plex server so I can play them, you know, through my phone speaker, even though they're not on my phone's hard drive. It's great. It's fine. It's idiosyncratic. And if everyone can do it, so much the better.
Yeah. Excellent. I can get behind that. All right. I got to get you out of here soon. A couple more things I want to say. So yeah. First of all, you and I are completely aligned on how copyright is not going to save us from AI. If you think that if you want copyright saved from AI, then you want a world in which web browsers are not allowed to show you the words on the New York Times webpage. Because like if the words are on the internet, something needs to be allowed to access them. If I oversimplified?
Yeah, I mean, more to the point, right? Like if you break down AI training into the components that maybe interact with copyright law, it's making a transient copy of a work, counting the elements of the work, and then publishing an index of those elements, right? So you like make a transient copy of a web page, you count the words and the distance between them. You then publish a literary work, which is a piece of software that encodes those distances as a vector matrix, right? And all of those things are very useful in and of themselves. And some of them don't implicate copyright at all. So it does implicate copyright to make a transient copy of a work. But without that, we don't get like the Internet Archive or web or search engines, right? Those transient copies are just like they're critical to it. If you want Google to be the last search engine we ever get, by all means, ban scraping. And by the way, that means we'll never find out what used to be on the CBS website before it was handed over to like a chud podcaster, because we won't have archives of it, right? The counting the aspect, the items in the work, right? Like just like enumerating the words or the pixels and what colors they have and their adjacency. That's not a thing that copyright implicates. And people, I think, have been misled by the Anthropic lawsuit, where Anthropic downloaded a bunch of pirate ebooks and then counted the words in them and then got sued for pirating the ebooks. And they have settled that lawsuit, but they didn't settle a lawsuit because they counted the words. Mm. They settled a lawsuit because they pirated the ebooks. If you go to a flea market and you buy a bootleg CD and you go home and count the number of vowels in the lyrics, you have not, like, the counting is not an infringement. Right? It's like, even if the work, the copy is infringing, counting the things and the infringing copy is not infringing. And then the publication of the work, like if you like bibliographies or anything else that's just like an index of facts about creative works, then you don't want to ban that. But look, maybe we could find a way to write a copyright law that outlaws all of that activity without harming any, without this collateral damage. Or maybe you think the collateral damage isn't important. I still think this is the wrong answer. Because for 40 years, we have expanded copyright. It lasts longer. It covers more works. It covers more uses. It has higher statutory damages. It's easier to get those damages. Media has gotten more profitable as a result. The media companies are larger and more profitable than they've ever been. And the share of income going to creative workers over that time has declined both in real terms and proportionally. And the answer to how this could be is something that Rebecca Giblin and I manage in our book, Choke Point Capitalism, from 2022. And it's just that in a market with 5 publishers, 4 studios, 3 labels, 2 companies that control all the apps, and 1 company that controls all the audiobooks and ebooks, getting more rights to bargain with is getting more rights to bargain away, right? It's like giving your bullied kid extra lunch money. It doesn't matter how much lunch money you give that kid. They are not getting lunch. And if you keep giving them lunch money, the bullies will have so much lunch money, they will launch an international campaign to give more lunch money to hungry school kids, right? And so what is the answer? Well, you know, the Hollywood writers went out on strike and beat AI. And the reason they beat it is because they, and only they, and the other guilds in Hollywood were exempted from the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act's prohibition on sectoral bargaining, which is when all the workers in a sector bargain against all the employers, where you don't have to organize workplace by workplace, right? All the fast food restaurants bargain with all the fast food workers, and all the auto companies bargain with all the auto workers, and so on. And so we have this conundrum right now, where, like, right now, artistic workers, creative workers are saying, my campaign is the same one my boss has, which is expanding copyright, a thing that no other worker in America gives a shit about. And the alternative would be saying, rather than expanding copyright, we're going to expand sectoral bargaining rights, which is a thing every other worker would love and your boss would hate. And just as a rule of thumb, that should be the thing you want. And if that's not good enough, the U.S. Copyright Office has repeatedly said and upheld all the way to the Supreme Court, which denied cert on this case, that works made by AI are not eligible for a copyright, which means the only way your boss can stop people from taking the things that your boss publishes and selling them without your boss's permission is to pay you to make them. And that should be like our absolute pole star, which is pay us or anyone can take it and sell it.
That's it. I mean, that is the answer. This thrilled me in your book. If in this world, I mean, look, I do not want nothing but slop to fill the pages of our books and to fill our movie theaters. But if they use AI to make slop, but they're not allowed to copyright it, that means they can't make money from it. And that means, ta-da, the major studios will not put slop on the big screen. That's it.
And if you're like a writer who likes to use AI to brainstorm, not a thing I like, but maybe you do, it doesn't implicate it, right? If copyrights, because that's not what you're publishing. If you're doing VFX where you're like moving the eye line of all the extras in a scene, doesn't matter. The eyeballs are in the public domain for 175 frames. Who gives a shit, right? So this is all Centaur stuff, not reverse Centaur stuff. This is the ideal configuration for this stuff.
I could not agree more. The book is The Reverse Centaur's Guide to Life After AI. Corey, I'm thrilled you're here. I'm thrilled you wrote this book. I was so not expecting it on the heels of Enchidification. And it was fantastic. Everyone should read it. Thank you, Corey.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that so much, Graham. Thank you.